Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. On today's program, we deal with fallout, economic fallout, that results from marketplace gyrations that might be bringing serious pain to the financial house of cards called global banking. The recent precipitous drop in oil prices may create some serious impacts that are yet unfelt as we gleefully fill our gas tanks for a fraction of our usual cost. But people's pensions and your bank deposits are riding on that oil market, so don't be too happy. This fallout reaches everywhere. And Ellen visits another kind of fallout over in Ireland, where the Troika, the European Central Bank, the EU, and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, have forced austerity on that nation and others to help ensure that the banks get their interest investments paid. Ellen visits with Green Party politician Mark Deary, who is actively working to get public banking adopted in Ireland as a solution to the fallout from a bank-initiated extortion that Ireland was subjected to in recent years. On the Public Banking Report, we visit with economy reformer Mark Armstrong about an important new citizen initiative called Commonomics to help defend public assets from being privatized. And we also talk about a new postal banking coalition, which is getting underway this week. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Well, this week there is good news and bad news on the oil front. The good news is that the price of oil has dropped below $50 a barrel. That means that gas will be cheap at the pump. The bad news is that the price of oil has dropped below $50 a barrel. That is particularly bad news for oil companies, banks, and the economy in general. Prices collapsed by more than 50% since last summer, so it wasn't due to ordinary forces of supply and demand. It was evidently manipulated by the Saudis, who have flooded the market with cheap oil. The question is, why did they do it? Some pundits say that it was the Saudis working in conjunction with the U.S. State Department, since John Kerry visited right before the drop. And the goal then was to get Russia and get Iran, which are heavily dependent on oil exports. But another theory is that it was to get the U.S. fracking companies, which are the Saudis' competitors in the oil market. The difference between Saudi oil and fracking oil is that fracking is much more expensive to produce. So the Saudis can withstand a long siege of low oil prices a lot longer than these fracking companies, which are liable to go out of business. And that has already started to happen. For example, in Canada, a big oil company is now insolvent, and one of their big investors is a big Canadian pension fund. So if the oil company goes bankrupt, the pension fund is going to bear heavy losses. So once again, it's we the little people who are going to be suffering the effects. We could be suffering in another way. The last time that oil dropped this low was nearly 6 years ago. So it was back at the last financial crisis, and we could be looking at another financial crisis of the same sort, triggered by the oil drop. The 2008 crisis was triggered by credit default swaps on subprime debt. In this case, it could be credit default swaps on fracking oil debt. These fracking companies are highly leveraged. They've funded themselves by borrowing, and the big banks were quite happy to make these loans because they were making huge fees on them, and the investors were happy to invest, including pension funds, because they can't make any sort of return anymore with the Federal Reserve's zero interest rate policy. They can't make a good return on conservative investments, so they're forced into these riskier investments. And the oil investments seem to be safe because they had the oil itself as collateral, and the oil price was quite high. But now that the oil price has dropped by more than 50%, the collateral has dropped by more than 50%. So if those loans go bad, then the credit default swaps on them, somebody is going to have to pay, the counterparty on the credit default swaps is going to have to pay huge sums in order to make up the difference between expectations and reality. The credit default swap is a form of derivative. Derivatives are basically bets. So you have one party betting that the price will go up and one party betting that the price will go down. Well, in this case, nobody bet that the price would go that far down or that the oil companies would be facing bankruptcy all across the country. So that could trigger a crisis just like the subprime debt did in 2008. So that's going to be a very interesting and rather frightening thing to watch. Another very interesting thing to watch is Europe, where in Greece, the Syriza party is ahead in the polls by 3%. They're retaining their lead. This is a leftist, anti-austerity, anti-bailout party, anti-oligarch party. They have vowed that if they get in, which it looks like they could well, the election is on January 25th for a new president. If they get in, they are going to renegotiate the debts with the IMF and do what they can to curb the power of the oligarchs. The reason the Greeks don't pay their taxes, so I actually heard from a Greek, is that they have a very corrupt government and people don't want to support this corrupt government. The politicians are in bed with the big old oligarchical wealthy families, and so they make deals among themselves, which are good for them and very bad for the ordinary citizens. So they'll be doing that, and they'll be doing New Deal style stimulation of the economy. So instead of putting their money, their existing money, into paying off old debts that won't do anything good for the economy, they'll be putting their money into various forms of productivity and stimulation the way Roosevelt did in the 1930s. And if that works, there'll be other countries that are right behind following suit. The next one is likely to be Spain, where the Padalón party is also a leftist, anti-austerity, anti-bailout party. So we could be seeing a movement toward the left and a wave of new policies in the EU, breaking away from the old austerity, balance the budget model into something that's more stimulating to the economy. Or we could see the southern countries breaking away from the northern countries. Or we could see, if the Troika doesn't accept this renegotiated loan, and if Greece doesn't pay on their loan, they may be forced out of the euro. So they may be forced back onto their own currency. So all that will be very interesting to watch. And in Ireland, they also were forced into austerity measures, first by the fact that their banks went bankrupt in 2008, but then more so when they accepted a bailout, or they were sort of extorted into a bailout in 2010 by the Troika, the ECB, the IMF, and the EU. And so there have been some very interesting recent developments there, and I will let my guests talk about that. My guest today is Mark Deary, the finance spokesman for the Green Party in Ireland. He is currently a councillor in his native county, Louth, and is a former senator in the last Fianna Fáil Green Party coalition government. I had the honor of meeting with Mark's colleague, Green Party leader Eamon Ryan, last November when I visited Ireland and participated in the Kilconomics Festival there. And it's a great honor to be interviewing Mark Deary. Great to talk to you, Mark.
Thanks, Ellen. The honor is mine, I can tell you.
I just love listening to your accent. Well, you're a strong advocate for public banking in Ireland, and of course I definitely want to get into that. But first I thought we should just lay a little groundwork talking about the Irish political system. In the U.S. we have a two-party system, and those are all the candidates that get in. No third-party candidate has ever been elected president, and at the moment there are only two members of Congress who are not either Democrats or Republicans. And, of course, the Democrats and Republicans are both big-money parties. They both rely on campaign donations from big banks. So the little people never really get a voice.
I actually ran for California State Treasurer on the Green Party ticket last year, so I saw what a hopeless cause it was. But you have a different system in Ireland, and the Green Party is actually does have a voice. In fact, you effectively brought down the coalition government in 2011 by withdrawing your support and forcing an early election.
That's right.
So I just wondered if you could talk a little about the Irish political system and how the Green Party got to be so influential.
Well, the Green Party is still a very small party in this country, and smaller than it was in the middle of the last decade. We had a couple of very good general elections. We have a multi-seat constituency system and a proportional representation voting system. So it means that people vote down the ballot paper, and preferences are as important as number one votes if you happen to stay in the race. So generally, Greens have got elected either to local authorities or to the National Parliament by being very transfer-friendly. You know, other people would vote for the big two or three parties and then give the Greens a third or a fourth preference. And these votes do count if you can stay in the race. So while we do get ourselves elected, we are vulnerable to shifts against us because they aren't, you know, our first preference vote wouldn't be as strong as we would like. But it does mean we stay in the race. I've run in five local authority elections since 2004 for town and county council, and I've been successful in them all. I've had a couple of cracks at running for the National Parliament and have come up short once, and in the last general election after that fall of that government that you just referred to, we didn't do well and lost all of our seats. We had six seats going into that general election in the National Parliament and lost them all. So currently we're not in Parliament. We had a good set of local elections there back in June in the South and in Northern Ireland, where there were local elections at the same time, on the same day indeed. And so we're back on local authorities as a party now and representing ourselves. And part of that process is about, you know, acting as, I think, politicians that all parties can work with on good ideas. We're not seen at the moment, in any case, as being a political or an electoral threat to maybe Labour or the two centre-right parties. So I have certainly found it possible to go to them with the public banking idea, which is something I ran with during the European election campaign, which I also ran in back in June. There were a parallel set of elections on the same day to the European Parliament. And, yeah, it's gathered a bit of traction since then, and there's definite interest from all of the parties that are currently in government or in the Parliament. And some of them understand it better than others. Some see the potential. The idea of public banking aligns much more closely with, I suppose, the centre-left parties in our Parliament. But nonetheless, because it's a model that really builds resilience in local businesses and in local economies, even the centre-right parties see merit in it too. The only ones who mightn't would be, you know, the pure monetarists at the extremes of those parties, or in other monetarist parties, you know.
I read various articles about you and your platform and so forth preparing for this interview, and I saw that you said that Ireland has a history of public banking, so it's not such a foreign idea to you as it actually is over here. I mean, like, we have one public bank for the last 100 years.
Banks were specifically set up in the past to address deficits in certain areas. During our industrial development, there was an industrial development bank established. There was an agricultural credit corporation established that specifically provided capital for the, you know, for a growing agricultural sector, and the savers were also members. You know, however, these were demutualized. You know, inevitably it came around to the moment where members were offered a dividend if they allowed the bank to be privatized, and I suppose the lure of early cash was too much for most, and unfortunately I think we sold couple of real treasures in our economy. But nonetheless, people are familiar with the idea of providing a specific member-based credit institution to address particular deficits in our economy. And those institutions served the country well for a number of decades before, unfortunately, they were swallowed up in the, I suppose, more liberalized financial regime that people thought was the end game for all of finance at one stage. You know, that was a real belief. And even our own co-op movement, and the co-op movement was really strong here in rural Ireland in particular, has gradually amalgamated into larger and larger entities that eventually, you know, became, you know, listed companies. And some of them would be names known around the world. So there has been a long history of, I suppose, mutual saving, mutual investment, mutual ownership, but all of it has kind of run to the sand. And we need to find that belief in ourselves again, that we don't need to rely on these private entities, but that we can coalesce around the idea of saving and lending within a region. And we can protect it in future from the kind of sell-off that we've seen in the past, if we get the legislation right, if we can get the process that far in this country.
Well, it looks to me, I just read an article about Greece and the fact that Goldman Sachs actually sent a memo to the Greek parliament in December, essentially threatening that if they didn't vote right, as the article I read said, that credit would be cut off to their banks from the European Central Bank. Well, all banks rely on central bank credit. I mean, the whole banking system is based on fractional reserve lending, which means that banks don't really have the money they lend. And what they rely on to balance their books is to be able to borrow. They borrow from the other banks very cheaply or from the central bank.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is extortion or blackmail to threaten to cut them off from what all banks need to survive under our existing system. And apparently that actually, I saw that you're now finally doing a banking inquiry into what went wrong in 2010 or what happened in 2010. Do you want to go into that whole history?
Yeah, well, that's absolutely similar leverage, if you like. Similar threats were made by Trichet.
He was president of the ECB in 2010.
The European Central Bank, that's right, in his communications with our then finance minister, the late Brian Lenihan. And the firm message was delivered that our money supply was also threatened, and so the policy options that were open to government at the time were very, very, very limited. And the 2008 bank guarantee, and I'm going back to that time, resulted from that complete shutdown on policy options, and effectively turned a crisis into a sovereign debt crisis. And the view still is held that Ireland was the first and is possibly still the only country to have been treated thus by the ECB, although you cited the case of Greece there, where more recent threats sound very, very familiar to my ears at any rate. But I believe, and I've said it at committee hearings, that we're invited to attend in Germany, organised by the German Green Party, about 2 years later, that we were treated disgracefully by the ECB at the time. I think that continues to be the widely held belief in this country. Nonetheless, there were reasons why we ran into the kind of massive debt problems that we encumbered ourselves with them in many respects, and I think we have to face up to that as well.
Yeah. I read somebody else that said that in 2008, unlike Greece, which had this huge debt that they were concealing that with the help of Goldman Sachs and their derivatives, Ireland was actually in the black, had a budget surplus in 2008. So the government itself did not necessarily have any responsibility for the Irish banks. And
no, that's right. It was bank lending mainly into the construction and property sector and into wider speculative lending that led to this massive overexposure. And
but the government
right
did
down
not
to mortgage lending, where the banks were lending 100% and more. They might give you the full mortgage plus the cost of a new car to try and get you to borrow from them, and scant regard was given to repayment capacity. It was all based, in fact, on the value of the asset that the borrower was buying. It was asset-based lending almost entirely. It was led by one particular bank, the notorious Anglo-Irish Bank, but the other traditional banks like Allied Irish, Bank of Ireland, who had been fairly prudential over the decades, saw this aggressive new competitor just taken lumps off them in terms of market share, and they got into the same game and very, very foolishly started lending in the same sort of reckless way. Anglo were the ones who ultimately were exposed when the property bubble crashed. They went to the other banks and asked for them to bail them out. That wasn't a possibility. And ultimately, the three banks went to government and said that the whole system was going to come crashing down. Government had literally to make an overnight decision, and the bank guarantee came to be probably too extensive in its reach in what it covered. certainly an extraordinary decision, okay. in that it was based on what the banks were telling government, and it turned out that what the banks were telling government was simply untrue, that there wasn't a simple liquidity problem or a cash flow problem. There was a far, far deeper underlying problem with the banks, and that was that all of their loans had gone bad. These enormous loan books had gone bad, and there was no value in them anymore. Huge. And that was not communicated to government at the time.
Mm-hmm. And apparently there was some pressure applied from Goldman Sachs and other foreign, the bondholders wanted their money back, and they got their money back, whereas under the new banking union, the bondholders' money will get converted into equity before they would go after the government's money.
Yeah.
But anyway, at that time, the bondholders got off scot-free, and they knew they were investing in something. They knew they were taking a risk where a government really doesn't have any actual responsibility for private banks. They only...
No. The state took on the private bank debt for fear of a collapse of the entire system on September 29th, 2008.
But I think there were some threats involved then too, right?
Foreign... One interesting thing, and I don't think it's that widely known, Anglo kind of managed to get their money the old-fashioned way. They offered very generous rates on deposits. Only a fraction, only about, I would say, probably 15% of their money was raised through bond issue, So where was the money coming from? The truth of it is it was coming from 100,000 small businesses around the country. It was coming from the credit union movement, which is a local cooperative savings movement that's very, very strong in every parish in Ireland. But the credit unions take savers' money and then lodge it, and they were lodging it where they could find the best rate they could get, and that was in Anglo. So the bank that was causing the most immediate problem was not actually that likely to be saved, even if the bondholders had been excluded. It really was our money that we were talking about in that particular case. I don't think that's been widely recognised, and perhaps that will emerge more clearly as this inquiry winds on. There have been three initial inquiries anyway, into the banking crisis. This is the first one that's been run by a parliamentary committee, though, and I think it's the first one that the public will actually feel that they have a say, or at least an aspect on. The others were delivered, and were quite technical, but this is one where we can tune in and watch it on our televisions and hear direct questions either evaded or answered directly. So I think the public are going to be very, very keen to learn about exactly what government faced on that night. And also, I think it's important that the players of the time, and that included the Greens, who were in government at the time, I think it's important that people understand that the source of our woes is not the guarantee. It was intended as a response to a massive policy deficit and a massive liberalisation around the oversight of the banks and an under-resourcing of the offices that were supposed to provide that oversight. There was a laissez-faire approach been taken, and that was a political decision taken as far back as 2001, 2002 by Fianna Fáil Progressive Democrat governments. So the problem was storing up over a number of years, and I would be sorry if the focus remained only on the night of the guarantee, which was a response to a much longer-term set of policy decisions that were storing up this enormous debt, private debt as it was at the time.
So the banking itself was rickety, and the private banking system was a failure. So in what sense do you see public banking as being a better system, and how will it fix those problems?
Oh, goodness.
Well, I agree with you.
Well, there are so many ways. I don't know if your listeners will be familiar with the phrase too big to fail, but we had those sort of banks. That was the perception that if they went down, they would take the euro with them, or they would take the country with them and the euro with them. They couldn't be allowed to fail. So I love that idea that the smaller the banks are, the better. And I think it was George Edwards making that observation recently when he was talking about commenting on the structure and makeup of the Sparkasse groups or banks in Germany. And I agree, the smaller and more localized the banking is, the better the lending can be, in theory at any rate. I'm not saying that any bank is immune from bad decision making and from bad lending and from going bust. All of that can happen. But it's not going to create the kind of systemic failure or domino effect or whatever metaphor you want to use. The regional banks are entities in themselves, and because their lending can be based on local knowledge and on partnering with the business or with the borrower and providing the kind of expertise that allows them to do proper projections around repayment capacity and around realistic expectations as to what turnover is going to be, and are not looking simply at the idea of lending on the basis of an asset that is going to infinitely increase in value. then you're highly unlikely, I think, to have a series of catastrophic bad loans go wrong and bring a bank down. But even in the event that that were to happen, they are regional structures. They can only lend within their own region. They can only exist in their own region. In Germany, in the Spark has a model. There are many shared services for efficiency reasons, but effectively the institutions are owned by the municipality.
And yeah, I think the problem with asset-based lending, I mean, one other problem with asset-based lending is that you don't create anything when you're, well, I suppose your housing market had boomed, but you want business to thrive in order to get the economy to thrive. And that means you have to invest in something that hasn't yet been produced, like you're investing in production. So that's a different type of loan than a housing loan.
People in this country got rich and made other people rich by selling fields to each other that nothing ever happened on, you know?
Wow.
And because if I may divert very slightly on that point you're making, asset-based lending also screws up your planning system because the pressure comes on local authorities in a massive way then to allow for future development. To make speculative borrowing and speculative purchasing realize value, lands have to fall prey to, you know, development potential or development zonings that may not be appropriate but that nonetheless happen. And then you get massive social consequences after that when the building does happen of isolated housing estates or housing that is very, very remote from workplaces or from education centres or from civic centres.
Yeah,
and we have all of that legacy.
You have a problem of young people can't afford housing. I mean, we have the same problem here.
Yeah, and what happened during the boom was that they had to move further and further away from where they were working or where they were from or where their families or parents were to find a place that they could afford, you know. So So the whole asset-based lending, to come back to the point that this country indulged itself in from the turn of this century onward up to the crash, had a profound effect on our planning and on the current shape of our towns and cities and villages indeed, which have in some cases large empty housing estates or unfinished housing estates attached, which have the capacity to house maybe two or three times the population of the village itself, you know. It's extraordinary stuff happened here. So we're trying to unravel a legacy of hundreds and hundreds of what are called ghost estates all around the country now. And
so,
I know my own local authority,
Louth
County Council, have a special unit established to try and resolve the unfinished estates in our own area because they are dangerous and they're an eyesore and they're in the wrong place in many cases. Some are not, and some can be developed and ought to be. But in many other cases, pre-developed lands need to just be returned to agriculture, you know.
And meanwhile, you have businesses that are languishing. I mean, that can't get
absolutely.
Loans.
That's the irony. Like I'm a business. Sorry, I'm jumping in there, Ellen. But I'm in business myself. I run a music venue in my hometown, and I employ 4 full-time people and about 10 part-time people. We run a decent operation, and I found it exceptionally difficult to get capital to develop the business further. When the only case I can make is a business case, is a cash flow case, is a business model case, because I can't point to any asset or I can't.
They can snatch if you don't pay. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have access to the kind of things that in the past at any rate used to attract capital, which was land and planning permission and speculative advantage and so on. I don't have any of that. I just have a business, so I've had to rely on, you know, other resources, family resources, supplier resources, you know, generous credit terms from suppliers to try and invest in my business. So taking off my business hat and putting on my political hat, if you like, during the election campaign last year when the public banking people in Ireland approached me and all of the candidates running for the European elections, inviting us to campaign in the European elections on the basis of the establishment of public banking. It was that aspect that really caught my ear, the fact that a local publicly owned bank will partner up with the businesses that it is lending to, because it's very much in its interest that the business thrives and that the loan is a solid one and a good one. My experience of the private banks in this country is that when you go to them for a loan, they send you away off into the arms of some business consultant who'll charge you €3,000 to come back with a business plan. And if they don't like it, they'll send you away again to stress testers, and that's another €1,000, you know. There are no resources within the privately owned banks and no willingness within the privately owned banks to actually help you with that work. Their only interest is in, and their obligation indeed, is to make sure that they maximise the dividends that they can offer to their shareholders at the end of the year. And they're legally bound to do that. So there's very little space for proper relationship banking, even though they call it that. It's not real. That's been my experience.
In Ireland, you're working on there is a government proposal, or I'm not sure what the stage of it is, but to service the small business community with a plan where the money would come from KfW, the German Development Bank. But
that's right. That's
public
right.
Banks would be better. Do you want to go into that?
Oh, definitely. We have this strategic banking corporation established now in this country, and it's a step forward. There's no question. But they're still channeling the funds through the private pillar banks, as they're called here. In other words, the Allied Irish Bank and Bank of Ireland. I don't really see, for instance, that the banks have been given the additional capacity that they would need to engage properly with small business sector and get that funding out to the towns and villages in the more remote parts of the country where it's so badly needed.
Mm-hmm.
We shall see. I shouldn't rush to judgment, but it doesn't strike me as going nearly far enough. But nonetheless, it does. There is a tacit recognition in the establishment
that it's needed.
Uh-huh. That it's needed. Correct. And I think one of the reasons we're having some success in our work here, in approaching the politicians and banks in this country, the central bank in this country, is that they are looking for a way of doing banking that actually does enervate and energise small communities at a very, very local level again, because for years and years the experience has been of branches being closed, banks becoming remote, and capital not being available to small local ideas. They're expensive loans to nurse, I suppose. The banks are probably more inclined to try and earn 4 or 5% off a really multi-million pound investment than put the time and effort into more marginal lending for smaller businesses that require more, hands-on help. I think that's where the system in Germany, the Sparkasse system, really scores so heavily. They are the last bank in the village, and they're not going to leave. They're obliged to stay, indeed. And even if that particular branch is loss-making, the obligation to stay there means that loss, if it can be sustained, is sustained by the region as a whole. I really admire that. I really admire the fact that profit maximisation is not the end game, but that building regional resilience is what it's all about.
Ironically,
and
I dearly
and passionately hope that we can continue to move the process on in this country with the political parties. And I have to say, people are listening and are trying to come to terms with what might be needed in terms of legislative rollout in Ireland, possible constitutional questions that might arise, the implications it might have for local government if municipal areas become the guardians of the bank. And I'd love to see that happen. I'm a great believer in local government, but our local government here has been very emasculated over the years. But, this could be a way back into really local government becoming a very, very relevant part of people's lives again at a very local level if we became the trustees. The whole question of board representation and expertise, all of that needs to be addressed.
It seems to me that it's a no-brainer once people understand it, how the public banks work. I mean, you're not competing with anybody. The credit unions service the consumer market, as you point out. They're not making business loans, I don't think, are they?
You're right there. It is the credit union network in Ireland lends for small consumption lending. I suppose you're right there, yeah. Holidays, TVs, home extensions, that kind of thing.
The three major banks are basically making housing type loans, and so nobody's really servicing the business community. And you could get, as you pointed out, and I actually wrote an article on it a couple of years ago, I think, that there's a loophole in the Lisbon Treaty that where it says that governments can't borrow from their from the central bank, but that publicly owned banks can, and I suppose that loophole was put in there just to service the German banks and that type of bank. So you should be getting in on that. That's a great exception that you could be borrowing the money for the capital from the ECB, then you can pay it back at their very low interest rate with the profits from your loans. You can leverage that, like your capital at 5%.
So it's a wonderful loophole, Alan, and I even got to talk about it on national television during the European election campaign when I was invited to take part in a couple of debates. So that's I wouldn't say it's well known, but it's certainly been ventilated at a national level that Article 123 of the Lisbon Treaty does make provision for public lending institutions to borrow capital from the ECB, and I would suggest to for the initial capital as well, because startup is going to be so difficult otherwise. And I know the Sparkasse group in Germany have what they call the International Foundation for Savings Bank Cooperative. I can't remember the exact title, but anyway, they relate different experiences from around Europe how initial capital can be tricky to get and to.
Yeah, that's the big issue here. I'm working on a public or a state-owned bank for California, and the first thing everybody asks is, where do we get the money? Because they're already tight on their budget. They don't want to have to come up with any money, but you can borrow it very cheaply. And because of the way banking works, I think that's what politicians that I've talked to don't really get, is that you only need a little bit of investment, and you can leverage that many times over into loans. And the interest on those many multiples of loans will quickly pay back whatever interest you're paying on that. You know, if you borrow the capital in the first place, so you borrow the capital at 3%, that's what I'm thinking, in California, then you could buy bonds. You could leverage that. In California, you can leverage that by a factor of 10. So you can pull that amount of deposits out of the Wall Street banks. Like, let's say the state of California would pull 10 times the deposits of its capital base to put into its bank, then it can create that sum in loans, so 10 times what the capital was, less the reserve requirement. And then, so you're making, say if you bought bonds, municipal bonds, you don't even have to take any risk. You just go out there and buy municipal bonds. You can buy 9 units of municipal bond at 3% and pay 1 unit of capital at 3%, and you're making 8 units at 3% for free, basically.
Yeah, and that differential then, you know, can be used to build up core capital, I presume.
So the Sparkasse people are actually over, and they're consulting with you, and they've told you all about their model. Do you?
More than that, yeah, they've done all of that. Some seminars, early last summer. But we've now met with senior people in both government parties and with the central bank and with the regulator's office in the central bank, and various moves are afoot now to try and bring that relationship much further on. The Sparkasse people have agreed to write a conceptual document, if you like, for us, that we and government have agreed to accept it and read it and consider it, and you know, the decision they then have to make is whether or not they want to resource the process further, bring in the Attorney General.
I should probably explain for our listeners that the Sparkasse are the German public banks. They have 40% of all business finance in Germany. They're actually the secret of Germany's success in being such a large exporter, although they're a relatively small country, because they have these local banks, local publicly owned banks. The profits go back into the bank to service, to make more loans, or if you follow the North Dakota model, the profits go back to the state itself as a dividend. So it's all kept in-house. You don't have profits being filtered out to big investors or to very high-paid CEOs like in our private banks. They're not dealing in derivatives. Their whole focus is on developing the local community businesses. Are particularly focused on businesses, right?
And I think that's the big point that scores when I talk to political colleagues or to government or to senior civil servants, and we've got to meet all of them at this stage. It's been really quite an encouraging process. But the idea of building local resilience has gone down really, really well, because we're a very, very open economy. Our economic success, if you like, has been based on foreign direct investment in a huge way, and our local enterprise is underdeveloped. And the key, I believe, to unlocking that and to really making small local businesses stronger and encouraging new ones to build is public banking, public regional banking. Because, as you say, the interest earned is retained, and the profits that any loan make are replowed into the local economy, into the next good idea, or into the next sound request that has come from a local business. So I just can't think of a more important initiative that might help, you know, build balanced economic growth right throughout Ireland that is real and sustainable and meets local needs and employs people in the regions and doesn't have us all congregating in Dublin, which is a ridiculously large city given the size of Ireland. Well over a quarter of the population lives in the one city, and it's getting bigger and stronger all the time, and the regions are not succeeding, and our spatial planning has not worked. It's been an absolute failure, actually, no matter what we try to do.
I think that's a big impetus now for, as things are failing. I mean, we can look back over the last 6 years since 2008 and say it just hasn't worked. I mean, their austerity measures haven't worked. They made things worse. You talk about the deflationary spiral that has resulted from all these austerity measures. Do you want to go into that and how public banking would reverse that syndrome?
Yeah, sure. Well, as you say, what's happened is that businesses have been seriously weakened by the fact that people haven't any discretionary money left to spend on anything, really, or haven't had. And it's certainly my own business, you know, buying a ticket to go and see a concert is well done. A list of priorities for anybody who's actually struggling to repay their mortgage or to, you know, meet the costs of raising a family or whatever it might be. And we've really, really struggled to stay open at times when money becomes so, so tight for people. So businesses have been very, very seriously weakened.
When I was over there, there was news of the economy was doing better and there was a certain amount of optimism, but I assume that's rather like here where you can't really believe the numbers or they're not looking
at... It's not people's experience. It's not my experience. I don't really like the phrase, but I don't see that consumer confidence in the marketplace yet. The figures are in this country are kind of distorted by the fact that so much of what passes for profitable economic activity is actually as a result of multinational companies engaging in all sorts of tax efficiencies that make our balance of payments look better. You know, so mm-hmm. because we are such an attractive country for particularly American FDI, and that's primarily because of our corporation tax rate, but also because we're English-speaking, we're culturally quite close to America, and we're in the European Union. But it means that headlines about Ireland's economic recovery may be true, but it's not real in the sense that it's not felt outside of those who are immediately employed in those sectors, mainly high-tech, pharmaceuticals, and so on. The local baker, the local, you know, joinery shop, the guy who makes kitchens, the woman who runs a small software business, whatever it might be, we're the ones who still don't feel that the recovery is on, and we can't escape and make efficiencies on the corporation taxes levied on us by the state, which is quite low to start with, but is ridiculously low when you look at the behaviour of the big multinationals here. And that's, I know it's something that exercises policymakers in the states too. But that's to divert a bit from the point. Just to get back to the idea of how public banks might actually reverse the deflationary spiral. First of all, the experience in Germany is that lending by the SPARCA is counter-cyclical. And in fact, their business has grown as the other banks throughout the European Union have been lending less and struggling more. So there is that tremendous advantage that counter-cyclical lending can bring to an economy. It balances out the peaks and troughs. It rubs them out, I should say. It turns the peaks and troughs into more gentle curves, and I think that's a tremendous asset and a tremendous reason for feeling confident about any investment you might make, is that you're not going to be subject to these horrendous peaks and troughs in the economic cycle that a strong regional banking system actually gives you predictability, because that is, I think, key to any business decision.
No, I think that's great. I mean, I totally agree that that's the way out of the cycle of the downward cycle of banks don't want to lend. They're afraid to lend. They have to make money for their shareholders. They're worrying about their stock price. In fact, nowadays it appears that businesses that executives are buying back their own stock just to drive up the price of the stock, so that they'll get more when they get out and get their capitalized on their stock options. So they have totally different motive than a public bank, which has a mandate to serve the public interest, and the bank gets to keep the profits, and they have low overhead, and they can use the profits for public things.
One other, we haven't spoken about this, but this is something that can be built into the requirements for any publicly owned institution, is that a proportion of profit is used for public welfare. I know that is the case where the banks are owned by the municipal districts in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I'd like to see being stitched into any possible legislation that we'll manage to achieve here in Ireland.
Yeah, that's great. I did write on the origins of the public banks and the German public banks, and they came up from the religious, I mean, they had a religious base where you had the banks that the poor people just couldn't afford. I mean, originally, the Catholics said that you couldn't lend at interest at all. Like, usury was a sin.
Yeah.
And then these certain religious groups went into lending sort of a pawn shop model where they, because the poor people just couldn't afford these 40%, 60% loans that the banks were charging, the private banks, and so, or the private lenders, and so they would go to these sort of pawn shops that would allow them to turn over some asset, and the interest rate was much lower. And finally, the Pope said that yes, indeed, that this was a good thing, that otherwise the poor were just, they didn't have any access to credit at all. So,
yeah, the history is interesting, and I think it's important to recognize that, you know, I've gone on a lot about one particular model, the only one I'm really familiar with, to be perfectly honest. But there are massive cultural differences between Ireland and Germany, and we need to recognise that. And in fact, one of the strengths, I think, of the approach that the foundation are making in their work here in Ireland is they're not being prescriptive in what they say at all. They're saying, this is how we do it. The landscape in your country is very, very different. The culture around money and saving is very different. And you do need to come up with your own model that fits local circumstances and local attitudes and the local approach. And that's something we do need
different.
To do. Totally different. And for instance, like they've told me that in Estonia, they were invited in by the municipalities in Estonia to try and initiate a public banking debate and process. So the municipal government is at the heart of the initiative in Estonia, whereas in Greece, local government is so debased, so untrusted by the people, that they've had to find a totally different model for trusteeship. Local government simply wouldn't be trusted with this important initiative. So it's different models are needed in different countries, but nonetheless there's a lot we can learn, and the Savings Bank Foundation for International Cooperation have been amazingly generous in the way they've given to the Irish process, and I know that they're hopeful that it will result, and so we all are hopeful that it will result in a decision by government to actually pursue it as a public policy and put forward a legislative platform to make it real.
Mm-hmm. You might be suspicious that they're trying to take over, like spread their banks, but in fact, they're not allowed to go out.
Not at all.
And so all they're doing is just helping. As I understand it, they're under a lot of pressure themselves to sort of privatize. I mean, they're being forced to give up the benefits of a public bank by having to come up with more capital, and so they're trying to make it known across the whole Eurozone that this is an excellent model and that we should be preserving it as it is.
That is key for them. I do think they feel like they're the last man standing in this area, and that they are under huge pressure, you know, in terms of banking legislation in Europe, capital requirements within Europe, and also the whole competition directorate, which might see public banking as in some way protected from the white heat of competition, which unfortunately is a direction that Europe has committed itself to, you know, and the social Europe is beginning to, I think, come apart, and you can see that on the streets of Europe. So, you know, there's a wider debate around whether Europe should continue to pursue, as it has historically, the, you know, model of high social provision and protection for people, and particularly for vulnerable people, and that debate is being lost, I think. That's the backdrop against which they are trying to get out there and promote the idea of public banking and public ownership generally, and strong local government. And I have to say, I support them all the way, and I want to see it happen in this country.
Well, it's been really great talking to you. I guess we're about at the end of our time. But I wish you all the best. Hope it all happens. I would love to...
Well, hopefully it will. You know, if government do decide to take this initial concept document that we're preparing through this month and run with it, we'd like to think that later in the year they will run a process where all the stakeholders publicly consulted and can respond, and that legislation will be prepared, and that this time next year we might be looking at something truly historic in this country. And I think the government could really do itself a huge favour. Okay, Ellen, thanks a million.
Yeah, thank you.
I've been speaking with Mark Deary, a finance spokesman for the Green Party in Ireland.
Today on the Public Banking Report, we speak with well-known economy reformer Mark Armstrong, who you may remember over the last couple of years pioneered a new postal bank resurgence in the form of a group called Bank Act, which acquired full-throated support of all four postal workers' unions and received a glowing report from the Postal Services Inspector General. Mark has now moved the Bank Act initiative into a more general effort called Commonomics, which you'll find at commonomicsusa.org. Its purpose is to pull together a broader coalition of support for preserving and expanding the commonwealth of communities.
Commonomics USA is simply a renaming of Bank Act. Bank Act had a laser focus on postal banking, but that has been successful in that this Monday there'll be a national coalition announced of 15-plus different organizations, and the ones driving the coalition right now are the postal labor unions. And so what we're doing is participating in it, but we want to duplicate the model in other economic justice areas like basic income, student debt jubilee, et cetera. So we're just expanding the scope of what our mission is.
They intend to fill a perceived hole in the fabric of public organizations that are working for economic change.
There's really no other organization that has a singular focus on teeing up activism and campaigns in the economic justice arena. So we decided what would those campaigns look like. Well, first of all, what the solutions look like, and now we're developing the campaigns. And the solutions, as you know, include public banking, postal banking, community bill of rights, which is kind of a new area, but there have been a number of different communities who have voted to basically obtain rights for themselves to prevent fracking or to put in place public banks, et cetera.
Mark says that there's a new realization that local economies are primary assets that belong to the people and deserve more powerful voices.
I think what we're all recognizing is that we have this greater awareness that we're not just part of one single national economy, that very much of our economy is local. And so you could even say that people are part of a local economy that is sovereign and independent of other economies, especially when you look at some of the different products and services being provided within those economies. Let's say food, just the production of food at a local level is critically important. It has everything to do with food security. And yet there are national laws, even state laws, which prohibit certain things and which tilt the scales of economic justice towards organizations like Monsanto and others, whereas people would really like to have a little more say in, you know, what kind of food is being produced locally and what seeds they use, et cetera. And so Community Bill of Rights is basically putting a stake in the ground and saying, you know, this is our economy, this is our right to make decisions, to plant certain seeds, to use heirloom seeds, to do a number of things, including to establish our own banking system, which will support our local economy.
One avenue of their action is to create legislative initiatives that reflect the need for new protections of public resources against the larger players in financial and political markets.
What we're finding is that there's a lack of really solid legislation, and so we want to take an open source model to that. And point of fact is with public banking, we think a very short piece of legislation could be introduced in any state house to basically protect taxpayers from bail-ins. What we can do is focus on making sure that the state treasurer in particular, but more generally state legislators, know that they have the ability to protect their own taxpayer money. And we know that solution is public banking, of course, a state-owned or city-owned public bank. But we want to raise awareness about that, because now that some of the key aspects of the Dodd-Frank bill have been repealed, we want to make sure that taxpayers' funds are protected. And so some of this legislation that we're developing will do that.
It all stems from a new awareness that common community wealth is not the sum of its available or invested dollars.
What we've realized, and other people have before us, is simply that the basis of wealth is not money. It's the ability to produce goods and services in order to meet the needs of everyone in a particular community. So when you look at a local economy and you look at that ability to produce goods and services, what's foundational to that is the commons. I mean, everything from airwaves being licensed to watersheds to any one of a number of other different things, including public spaces. But all of these can be used to support a wealthier community as long as they're protected and, frankly, as long as they're expanded. And what we're used to in our society is how the commons is kind of targeted as something to be exploited and used for private gain. And it's just assumed that that's the way to greater wealth. What we're saying is, no, actually, expansion of the commons and protection of it is the way to increase the wealth of the people. And that's why we've changed our name to Commonomics USA. And the other aspect to this is that many of these other areas, economic justice areas that we're talking about, whether it's postal banking or student debt forgiveness, basic income, all of that has to do with, you know, recognizing that the money creation process, for instance, and banking, that should be part, that's a utility. That should be part of the commons as well.
And Commonomics plans to help synergize the many citizens groups that are working in the same general field so they can benefit from their respective assets and energies.
Our focus is developing partnerships with peer organizations, other nonprofits that may have a history in social justice issues ever since Occupy. They've been, and maybe before that with the 2008 crisis, they're getting more involved with economic justice issues. But they don't know what the solution set is. They don't know what the messaging is. They don't know what the campaigns are, and specifically some of the media, social media campaigns. And so that's our niche. We provide all that to other nonprofits who want to embrace some of these solutions and further them within their own network of people.
That was Mark Armstrong, founding director of the new Commonomics USA Economy Reform Movement. Visit them at commonomicsusa.org. That's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, brought to you with support from Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to the cause of economic justice and fairness and to the creation of new American public banks. Visit them at paymentmgmt.com to request a complimentary analysis of your current card processing expenses. Be sure to follow Ellen Brown's commentary and the blog discussions, which are really quite invigorating and informative, by going to ellenbrown.com. And you can hear previous editions of this program through podcast by going to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown at prn.fm. Our thanks to Payment Management, our guests, prn.fm, and to you for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.